Now, when this strange circumstance was made known aft, the carpenter was at once commanded to do Queequeg's bidding, whatever it might include. There was some heathenish, coffin-colored old lumber aboard, which, upon a long previous voyage, had been cut from the aboriginal groves of the Lackaday Islands, and from these dark planks the coffin was recommended to be made. No sooner was the carpenter apprised of the order than, taking his rule, he forthwith, with all the indifferent promptitude of his character, proceeded into the forecastle and took Queequeg's measure, with great accuracy, regularly chalking Queequeg's person as he shifted the rule. "Ah, poor fellow, I'll have to die now," ejaculated the Long Island sailor. Going to his vice-bench, the carpenter, for convenience sake and general reference, now transferringly measured on it the exact length the coffin was to be, and then made the transfer permanent by cutting two notches at its extremities. This done, he marshaled the planks and his tools, and to work. When the last nail was driven and the lid duly planed and fitted, he lightly shouldered the coffin and went forward with it, inquiring whether they were ready for it yet in that direction. Overhearing the indignant but half-humorous cries with which the people on deck began to drive the coffin away, Queequeg, to everyone's consternation, commanded that the thing should be instantly brought to him, nor was there any denying him, seeing that of all mortals some dying men are the most tyrannical, and certainly since they will shortly trouble us so little for evermore, the poor fellows ought to be indulged. Leaning over in his hammock, Queequeg long regarded the coffin with an attentive eye. He then called for his harpoon, had the wooden stock drawn from it, and then had the iron part placed in the coffin along with one of the paddles of his boat. All by his own request, also, biscuits were then ranged round the sides within. A flask of fresh water was placed at the head, and a small bag of woody earth scraped up in the hold at the foot. And a piece of sailcloth being rolled up for a pillow, Queequeg now entreated to be lifted into his final bed, that he might make trial of its comforts, if any it had. He lay without moving a few minutes, then told one to go to his bag and bring out his little god, Yojo. Then, crossing his arms on his breast, with Yojo between, he called for the coffin lid, hatch he called it, to be placed over him. The head part turned over with a leather hinge, and there lay Queequeg in his coffin, with little but his composed countenance in view. "Rar my, it will do, it is easy," he murmured at last, and signed to be replaced in his hammock. But ere this was done, Pip, who had been slyly hovering nearby all this while, drew nigh to him where he lay, and with soft sobbings took him by the hand, in the other holding his tambourine. "Poor rover! Will you never have done with all this weary roving? Where go you now? But if the currents carry you to those sweet Antilles where the beaches are only beat with water lilies, will you do one little errand for me? Seek out one Pip, who's now been missing long. I think he's in those far Antilles. If you find him, then comfort him, for he must be very sad. For look, he's left his tambourine behind. I found it. Rig-a-dig-dig-dig. Now, Queequeg, die, and I'll beat you your dying march."
"I have heard," murmured Starbuck, gazing down the scuttle, "that in violent fevers men all ignorance have talked in ancient tongues, and that when the mystery is probed it turns out always that in their wholly forgotten childhood those ancient tongues had been really spoken in their hearing by some lofty scholars. So to my fond faith poor Pip, in this strange sweetness of his lunacy, brings heavenly vouchers of all our heavenly homes. Where learned he that but there? Hark, he speaks again, but more wildly now.
Form two and two! Let's make a general of him! Ho, where's his harpoon? Lay it across here! Rig-a-dig-dig, huzzah! Oh, for a gamecock now to sit upon his head and crow! Queequeg dies game! Mind you that, Queequeg dies game! Take you good heed of that, Queequeg dies game! I say game, game, game! But base little Pip, he died a coward, died all a shiver. Out upon Pip! Hark ye, if you find Pip, tell all the Antilles he's a runaway, a coward, a coward, a coward! Tell him he jumped from a whaleboat! I'd never beat my tambourine over base Pip and hail him general if he were once more dying here. No, no. Shame upon all cowards. Shame upon him. Let him go drown like Pip that jumped from a whaleboat. Shame, shame!"
During all this, Queequeg lay with closed eyes, as if in a dream. Pip was led away, and the sick man was replaced in his hammock. But now that he had apparently made every preparation for death, now that his coffin was proved a good fit, Queequeg suddenly rallied. Soon there seemed no need of the carpenter's box,
And thereupon, when some expressed their delighted surprise, he, in substance, said that the cause of his sudden convalescence was this. At a critical moment, he had just recalled a little duty ashore which he was leaving undone, and therefore had changed his mind about dying. He could not die yet, he averred. They asked him, then, whether to live or die was a matter of his own sovereign will and pleasure. He answered, certainly. In a word, it was Queequeg's conceit that if a man made up his mind to live, mere sickness could not kill him. Nothing but a whale or a gale or some violent, ungovernable, unintelligent destroyer of that sort. Now there is this noteworthy difference between savage and civilized, that while a sick, civilized man may be 6 months convalescing, generally speaking, a sick savage is almost half well again in a day. So in good time my Queequeg gained strength, and at length, after sitting on the windlass for a few indolent days, but eating with a vigorous appetite, he suddenly leaped to his feet, threw out arms and legs, gave himself a good stretching, yawned a little bit, and then springing into the head of his hoisted boat and poising a harpoon, pronounced himself fit for a fight. With a wild whimsiness, he now used his coffin for a sea-chest, and emptying into it his canvas bag of clothes, set them in order there. Many spare hours he spent in carving the lid with all manner of grotesque figures and drawings, and it seemed that hereby he was striving in his rude way to copy parts of the twisted tattooing on his body. And this tattooing had been the work of a departed prophet and seer of his island, who by those hieroglyphic marks had written out on his body a complete theory of the heavens and the earth, and a mystical treatise on the art of attaining truth, so that Queequeg in his own proper person was a riddle to unfold. A wondrous work in one volume, but whose mysteries not even himself could read, though his own live heart beat against them. And these mysteries were therefore destined in the end to moulder away with the living parchment whereon they were inscribed, and so be unsolved to the last. And this thought it must have been which suggested to Ahab that wild exclamation of his when one morning turning away from surveying poor Queequeg, "O devilish tantalization of the gods!"